Look closely and you will find poison risks hidden in plain sight inside every house. But there are actions you can take to poison-proof your home, like keeping household cleaners locked up high and away from children, properly labeling and securing medicines and supplements, and installing carbon monoxide detectors near bedrooms and furnaces. Visit poisonhelp.hrsa.gov to learn more, or call your local poison center at 1-800-222-1222, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Welcome to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, and it is a pleasure to be celebrating women through Women's History Month, Women's Recognition Month, and all things women, because as a woman, why not, right? Lots to celebrate always. And it's a wonderful time to be able to really shed a light, and I tease, but to shine a light on so many brilliant and intelligent and impactful women that have come before us and those that we know will follow. So we are celebrating and we are honoring and we are respecting not only the women in our lives, but the women that have helped endure things and help enrich our lives. One of those women, at least in my world, is Dr. Brenda Hildreth, to be very frank. And she is, of course, representing counseling at Henry Ford College. And you wear so many hats, Brenda, but we're always thrilled to have you on our show to talk about whatever you're involved in at that particular time, and appropriately so. For this discussion, it's Women's Recognition. And there is a splendid luncheon that some of our listeners might be familiar with, others perhaps learning about this for the first time. But this is something that we want everybody to think about, everybody to listen to, because we want them to participate. So welcome to you. Thank you for being here. And tell us a little bit about your history with the Women's Recognition Luncheon.
Well, I've been working with the committee ever since I started here, which was, I believe, 2009. So I've been around for a while with the luncheon. And it's always been such a great pleasure to do it because it's for such a good cause. All of the money that we raise from the luncheon goes directly to our emergency fund. And that fund is distributed to students who find that they are having a financial emergency.
Okay. To participate, then, we want to make it very clear that you do not have to be an employee of Henry Ford College, a student of Henry Ford College. This really is something that is open to the entire community, correct?
It is, yes.
Very good. And I have been with the college many, many years myself, and I have my plan every year is to attend this event. I know we had virtual in recent past, but this one's coming back on campus, and we're very excited to have it back. Every year, it's a little different. There's a little bit of a sort of an energy that comes out of these luncheons. But one thing that is consistent, whether it is face-to-face or, you know, remote, whatever the case, they really feel very empowering, at least to me as a guest of the event or as a patron of the event. And I really think that that is the key here, because when we empower our, you know, women, when we empower our community to be better, serve more, you know, shine a light on those that are great examples as leaders, it brings us all up. So what should we expect for this year, which happens to be, by the way, the 48th annual Women's Recognition Luncheon? And I know neither of us, as we both indicated, weren't here for that long, but it certainly, I'm sure, has seen its changes along the way. But this year sounds very, very special. Tell us about it.
This is very special for one reason, because we're back on campus after being away for so long. So I'm really excited to be able to see everyone again so that we can participate in this event. Our theme for this year is fanning the flames of aspirations and dreams. And so it's going to be a very inspiring event. Our graphics that we're using is a peacock. And the peacock is being used because, as you know, it's a very beautiful bird. And it's a very proud bird. It walks like it has a lot of power. And so we thought that it would be an excellent icon for us to use.
Love that. Fanning the flames of aspirations and dreams. If we circle back to how we started this discussion today, you indicated about the proceeds that this event raises and what they go towards. Talk about fanning the flames of aspirations and dreams. You know, that is a direct goal for everyone that is involved in the campus of Henry Ford College, because we want to fan the flames of the dreams and the aspirations of our students. And all of the funds raised for this event go directly to that, as you indicated, student outreach and support, as well as the Hawkstrong Emergency Fund. Every year I get a little emotional at these events, Brenda, because there's always a story or two, a student or two, a happy ending concept that we hear about and that we learn about. And it does seem so important to put faces and put stories with the general concept of let's raise some money for our students. It just makes it more personal and more relatable. Can you share your thoughts as one of the members of the committee organizing this event as to what we might expect without giving anything away this time around?
Well, we hope to have a student who will be able to come in and share their personal story, because, as you said, that does really make it becomes a highlight, because that's what we're all there for, so that another student next year can have a story to share with us. And so that's going to be something that we're going to look forward to. We always look forward to the wonderful food that is prepared by our own students. And I am so proud of that whole department, the Culinary Arts Program, because they do a fantastic job every year. And they look good, too, in their white uniforms with the hats. And they just look very good. So we look forward to that wonderful lunch that we always have. Our tradition has become salmon because of the time of the year. We always have a vegetarian selection as well. And our Michigan salad. We'll surprise our guests with the rest of the things that are on the menu, but we will have our two traditional dishes.
Love it. That's wonderful. We are really thinking about an event that could be interpreted a number of different ways. You could just come out for the luncheon. You could come out if you like to bid on auction baskets, which is another personal favorite of mine for the event, or you could just come out to be inspired. But the beauty here is you really get all of that, you know, depending on what put you in that seat. You're getting all of this, and might I say, it's a pretty reasonable charge for this as well. When we talk about the event, it opens officially at 11, and this again Friday, March 31st, so it's about 3 weeks away. Plenty of time. We wanted to make sure that we have plenty of time for our listeners to check their calendars, move things on their calendar so that this can be a part of their Friday, March 31st, here on the campus of Henry Ford College, Evergreen Road in Dearborn. And in the process of fanning the flames of aspirations and dreams, people can come in and actually create a sponsorship of sorts and become a sort of a bigger part of this event versus the opportunity to just come in and experience it as a luncheon participant. So how does that work? How can we get more of our community involved for those that are thinking, "Why, this sounds like a wonderful thing. I'd love to participate. I'd love to sponsor." What should they do?
Well, we always have information on how they can set up that sponsorship on in our program, so they'll have it to take with them when they leave. But it's an excellent opportunity because, again, they can give year-round if they want to make sure that these students who are trying desperately to complete their education are not stopped because of something like a flat tire, you know, and they can't get to classes anymore because they can't afford to replace it. So we're hoping that people will, who are listening to this show, will take advantage of that opportunity.
Sounds great. There are multiple levels of sponsorship, all the way from the top with the platinum level, gold, silver, bronze, pearl, and then the individual level. And that includes a ticket to the luncheon. And so that's a wonderful thing. And what I also enjoy is the opportunity to see students, again, not only the presenter or, you know, the one that's maybe telling their story on the stage, but also just students that are, you know, young women that are there, that are, or not so young women, you know, of all ages, that are really in the process of having those flames fanned as they are figuring out their dreams and they are achieving their aspirations through Henry Ford College. It really is just the best feel-good event. I look forward to it every year, and I hope our listeners will consider, if you can attend, please do, and if you can't, maybe make a sponsorship donation. That would be wonderful. Now, Brenda, we talked about two components of this event that are benefiting, and in general, it's the students, but two organizations on campus, Student Outreach and Support, which I know you are intimately familiar with, and the other one is the Hawk Strong Emergency Fund. You just mentioned that scenario about a student potentially that has a flat tire, doesn't have the money to get the tire changed, and so has to miss classes, and that could potentially set them back in their plan, in their potential for graduation and moving forward. It's one simple thing to some of us, is astronomical and really life-changing to potentially a student. And that falls under the Hawk Strong Emergency Fund component, as I understand it. Tell us a little bit more about the process of how that that is set up. And I understand it's an award that a student can apply for, basically, if they're having an emergency, and the college will help them out. It's a, you know, one-time kind of a thing. But I understand that through the use of funds raised from this luncheon every year, the award amount that a student can acquire has increased quite a bit, which is pretty incredible. And then after that, let's talk a little bit about SOS, Student Outreach and Support.
Okay, we were able to increase the amount of money or the maximum award after the pandemic. Well, it's because the people are so giving who participate. And because of that giving spirit that they have, we were able to increase the amount of money or the maximum award from $150 to $500. And that was badly needed because, as we know, everything is really expensive now. And so $150 does not really help with anything. So I'm very grateful to the people who have given over the years and made that possible for us to do. The office that I'm working in, Student Outreach and Support, plays a role in this because all students, unfortunately, do not qualify for various reasons. Usually is connected to financial aid issues. But if they don't qualify, that doesn't mean that we still can't help them in some way. And so we make sure that they are connected with agencies and nonprofits and even state offices that may be able to assist them so that that need that they have is still going to be met.
That's incredible. The statistic showed in the listing for this event last year, the award overall for HFC students was over $42,000. Yes. That's a big amount, and that helped about 165 Henry Ford College students to continue doing what they're here to do, which is get their education and take that next step on their life journey, and to be a part of that in some small way, and to acquire just a lovely lunch and a beautiful afternoon in the process is a win-win as far as I'm concerned. And Brenda, I know you have put your heart and soul into what you do with the Student Outreach and Support program, as does every single person on the list of the luncheon committee. And we know that this is not an easy undertaking, especially bringing it back after so many years, not being able to have it on campus, kind of having to start all over again. but we're looking forward to the things that we have come to expect if we've been to this before, and to newcomers that I hope will support this wonderful event, which supports our students. We hope that it's just going to be a lovely event, and we know it will be because you're involved with it and all these other wonderful women. Now, to clarify, the event on March 31st, there is still time to acquire tickets to come to the event at Henry Ford College. And also still time, if we act quickly, to also participate as a sponsor and get your name in the program and all that kind of thing, correct?
Yes, it is. Okay. And you can do that online.
Great.
So if you're interested in buying tickets, you would go to the foundation webpage and the college's website, and it will guide you to the right area where you can purchase your tickets. Or if you don't plan to attend the luncheon, you can also just make a contribution, a one-time contribution.
That's
true.
There
are a lot of ways that you can be supportive.
Love it. hfcc.edu is our website, hfcc.edu. And don't forget that it's just so easy to navigate. You'll see there's a beautiful big square box that talks about the luncheon. Just literally click on that, and it takes you to all these wonderful things that we're talking about. If you'd like additional information and the web thing is just not for you, I think Diana Larson is the name that's listed on this. So we'll give our lovely Diana's name, and she works in the foundation office and has for many years. So Diana Larson can be reached at 313-317-6839. One more time, 313-317-6839. One of the other aspects of this luncheon is an opportunity to shed a spotlight on some of the women in our own campus community and our community at large, to really showcase some of the best of the best as an inspiration to others that are participating. Can you speak just briefly to that sort of friendly competition or opportunity? Yeah.
It is a friendly competition, and it's something that's very exciting because everyone is waiting to find out who will be the winners this year. And so we're in the process of collecting the nominees now, and I can't wait to find out myself who is going to be the winner. We always select someone from the faculty, from our supportive staff, and from our administrators. So there are three people on campus who we will be acknowledging for all of the wonderful work that they do throughout the year with our students.
Great. And if that isn't enough to, talk about this wonderful, wonderful event, we've got the raffle as well. So some people just want to come and buy some raffle tickets. And again, all proceeds benefiting the wonderful HFC programs that we've spoken about. So there really is something for everybody.
It is. The raffles are a lot of fun. And we always, for the last few years, we have given the departments on campus an opportunity to get in on the fun, where they can create a basket that represents their department, and it will be raffled off as well.
Excellent. Well, we're looking forward to it. We want to encourage our wonderful giving community to participate in some way for this, the 48th annual Women's Recognition Luncheon here on the campus of Henry Ford College in the M building, the Student and Culinary Arts Center. And as Dr. Hildreth mentioned, a delicious luncheon for all, certainly. And I suppose we should clarify, this isn't just for women, correct?
Oh, correct. It's for any and everyone who would like to attend.
Excellent. Brenda, thank you as always for your time, and give our best and gratitude to the committee for what I know is going to be another wonderful event. We hope to see as many of our HFC loyal listeners as possible. Let's make it a sellout this year here for 2023.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Always a pleasure. We wish you well and look forward to seeing you at the luncheon. And we look forward to seeing you at the luncheon also. So if you'd like more details, and Brenda, shall we share your phone number as well, just in case, sure. For just general thoughts on questions to be answered?
Sure. Any questions can be given to me. My phone number is 313-845-9757.
Great. 313-845-9757. Dr. Brenda Hildreth here, one of the women that we recognize every single day at Henry Ford College, more than she knows, for her support of our students and our campus community. Brenda, it's been a pleasure as always. We wish you all the best, and thank you for continuing this wonderful tradition with the Women's Recognition Luncheon.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We've got more on the way. This is the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here. Please stay with us.
Do you hear those noises? Those are the sounds of Thematic, hosted by Phil Mack, expanding to 4 hours from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Wednesday afternoons. Excuse me, I have to talk to the construction crew. Hey, can you make sure there's plenty of room for new music and new artists? Yeah? We'll make it bigger than that. Make sure to save some space for a few classic songs, too. Don't forget to add some areas for interviews and countdowns and every single genre you can think of. And then add more. Can you guys stop for a moment? Because this is the most important thing. Make enough room for all listeners to fit. That's Thematic every Wednesday from 12 to 4 p.m.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon. And we continue on our program as we flip the calendar to the month of March. We also move from celebrating Black History Month to celebrating Women's History Month here on the WHFR Journal. We're going to do that with a couple of special programs for you today. Coming up, we'll have a special program from the series What's the Word? Talking about women warriors from Joan of Arc to G.I. Jane. A look at women warriors. That's going to be coming up in just a couple of minutes here on our program. But first off, a short segment entitled A Good Day to Believe in Your Power. Aisha Clark, climate activist. This comes from a series from KALW in San Francisco, also the home of Philosophy Talk, the program that precedes us at noon on Fridays here on WHFR, part of a series called Inflection Point. And it's episode one from a special segment for Women's History Month about how we can build a more feminist future and take care of ourselves and each other when the work is daunting. This segment also coincides with the new book, It's a Good Day to Change the World, Inspiration and Advice for a Feminist Future. Let's listen to it now. A Good Day to Believe in Your Power. Aisha Clark, climate activist here on the WHFR Journal.
What does it take to create an equal, just, and joyful world? And how do we sustain ourselves when the work is daunting? I'm Lauren Schiller, creator of Inflection Point and co-author of the new book, It's a Good Day to Change the World. We're bringing you a special segment every week of Women's History Month about how we can build a more feminist future and take care of yourself and each other along the way. Today we hear from Aisha Clark about how to believe in your power. Aisha is a founding member of Youth Versus Apocalypse, an activist organization that organized the first ever youth climate strike in San Francisco. Aisha has been fighting for climate justice since junior high school. That's when they spoke out against a coal terminal slated to be built in their hometown of Oakland, California. A few years later, they confronted Senator Dianne Feinstein about the Green New Deal in a video that went viral. Aisha believes we all have the power to reverse the climate crisis.
It started as early as I can remember is listening to my grandpa's stories about his activism. He burned his draft papers and like peed in front of the Koch brothers building in protest and like has done all these really incredible things his entire life. And just hearing all of his stories and just seeing him lead by example, I think was kind of my earliest introduction into social justice and knowing that I wanted to be like that. You know, all the oil refineries are put in communities of color. The coal terminals that are being planned to build are built through communities of color, and pipelines are built through indigenous water supply and sacred lands. And I really realized how central environmental racism is to climate justice and how historically the environmental justice movement didn't reflect the actual people who are on the front lines of the injustice. Young people who are leading this movement have been getting a lot more attention. Our job is both to redefine what climate justice means and really working on the movement from the inside, trying to make sure that frontline voices are always centered and that we have this very clear agenda to normalize climate justice and reverse the climate crisis. This is a fight for lives. Really, it's about creating an equitable, just world and to make sure that the new world that comes from that is sustainable and is run by solutions that are created by frontline communities.
And now, some of Isha's tools to change the world. First up, imagine new systems.
Fighting the climate crisis is also fighting all of the systems of oppression that undergird our world that have led us to this crisis. And we're taking on the task of completely dismantling everything that we know. And that is really scary. And people say that it's idealistic. And so I think the largest task is shifting from believing that what we need is idealistic and finding a way to do it.
Second, resist delay.
You know, we've had this action at Chevron, and we actually got to talk to some Chevron executives. And what we were saying was we don't have time for this long, slow transition to renewable energy. We just don't have that time. And they were saying, you know, well, change is slow. And over the course of history, you see that change has been slow. And that's exactly the problem. We cannot do things the way that they've been done before, and that scares people.
Third, keep the pressure on.
Pressure makes diamonds. I think that the biggest thing that we can do is to never forget the power that we have as the people. And really, I have to emphasize this point that power holders would not have power if it weren't for the people. And so, just every day as a mantra, as an affirmation, remind yourself that you have power, and that power is multiplied and multiplied as you link arms with other people and stand in solidarity.
And finally, how do we sustain ourselves when the work is daunting?
I'm starting to realize that the only thing that really matters is that you feel comfortable in the body and in the being that you are. But that's really hard to do in a society that's telling you what you should do and who you should be all the time. So it takes a lot of self-reflection and self-awareness. Something that I started doing was keeping a journal. Sometimes I'll do like a really corny journal entry, and sometimes I'll write a poem, or sometimes I'll make a list, you know, it clears my brain. And that's when I really get to check in with myself, and also just seeing like what gets put on the paper. What was I thinking today? What did I do today?
Find more of Isha Clark's story along with tools in It's a Good Day to Change the World, our new book based on Inflection Point interviews. You can find it wherever you get your books. Learn more at inflectionpointradio.org. This series was produced in collaboration with KALW. Our executive producer is David Boyer. Our impact producer and my co-author is Hadley Dynack. I'm Lauren Schiller.
This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Kitty Love comes up at that time with Highway 61, some blues for your Friday afternoon. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
The best radio shows are filled with musical surprises. They take you on twists and turns that you never expected. You get a chance to hear new music you weren't familiar with, along with classics you hadn't thought about in years. That's what I try to do on Light from the Underground. I'm Bill Keith, and I enjoy digging through all the new releases we've received to find the best new music for you. I focus on singer-songwriters across a wide variety of genres. Add in some blues, maybe a dash of gospel music, and some indie rock to mix things up, and you have Light from the Underground. I want to take a moment to thank Henry Ford College for making WHFR possible. Their investment allows us to create radio that's focused on our community. Check out Late from the Underground, Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on 89.3 WHFR.FM. We're making waves.
Hey, so what's a great way to spread awareness that driving high is illegal everywhere? A catchy song, of course.
You can't run, or you can't drive high. You can't run, or you can't drive high.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is the WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek, as mentioned, with you until 2 o'clock this afternoon. We do hope you'll stick around as we celebrate Women's History Month here in March on the WHFR Journal. We do that up next by turning to another program. This one comes to us from the Modern Language Association. We always find very interesting producers and series to bring you excerpts from on this program, and this one is no exception. To celebrate Women's History Month, their program, an episode of What's the Word? Women Warriors, from Joan of Arc to G.I. Jane, a look at women warriors. Let's listen to it now here on today's edition of the WHFR Journal. We do hope you enjoy.
From the Greek goddess Athena to television's Xena warrior princess, from Joan of Arc to G.I. Jane, history, mythology, and contemporary literature and film offer many images of women warriors. I'm Sally Plaxen. On this edition of What's the Word, Susan Crane takes us back to the Middle Ages with a look at Joan of Arc and the transcripts of her trial for heresy.
This record makes Joan by far the best documented female mystic, female leader of troops, female cross-dresser of the Middle Ages.
Shirley Lim talks about Maxine Hong Kingston's book, The Woman Warrior.
It's a book that's had a tremendous influence, not only in Asian American literature, but in all of U.S. canonical writing, I would say.
And Yvonne Tasker explores the portrayal of a female naval officer in Ridley Scott's 1997 film, G.I. Jane.
She wants to be treated the same as the men she's competing with. She wants to go head-to-head, in effect.
Join us on this edition of What's the Word? Women Warriors.
Joan of Arc is certainly the most well-known woman warrior of the earlier centuries of Western Europe.
Susan Crane is a professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University. She has written about Joan of Arc in her book, The Performance of Self.
She's also the best documented of those warriors because of the long testimony she gave during her trial at the end of her life, her trial for heresy, when she'd been captured by the English. She's the patron saint of France. She has the distinction of being the only saint in the Christian church who was first condemned as a heretic and turned over to be burned at the stake by the state, and then declared a saint by the same church several centuries later.
Joan was born around 1412 in Domremy and grew up during the Hundred Years' War,
which was a long series of wars, really, in which the English kings were claiming a hereditary right to the French throne.
In 1429, when Joan was about 18, she made her way to the court of Charles VI's son, who was not yet crowned, and therefore known as the Dauphin, a title given to the eldest son of a king of France.
And she told him that she'd seen visions instructing her to lead an army to fight the English, and that she would regain France for the French king, that is, the Dauphin would become Charles VII and would rule over a reunified France.
Crane speculates about the impression the young Joan, daughter of peasant farmers, must have made on the court.
She must have seemed shocking to the court in several ways. First of all, she was saying she needed to command an army
but she wasn't of the rank of people who controlled the army. That is, she wasn't an aristocrat. The job of peasants was to be foot soldiers in armies, not to lead troops. Also, she was a woman. There are some classical models of women fighters, such as the Amazons. There are a few women who fight in the Bible, like Judith. But in social practice, women did not fight in medieval France. In the third place, she was wearing men's clothing. In the Middle Ages, women simply did not wear men's clothes in the normal course of their lives. And the fourth way, of course, that she was very startling was that she said she had had visions from God that she should do this. Women really couldn't have authority inside the institutional church except by doing this kind of end run around the church's hierarchy by having direct access to visions from God. But to have visions is always subject to doubts and investigations in a way that, say, a masculine career path of leading a monastery and writing books and preaching is not really subject to doubts and interrogations.
Despite these challenges, Joan of Arc was given an army and had some significant victories.
Notably, she raised the siege of Orleans, a northern city that had been besieged by the English for some time and was in great stress. She also achieved other military victories and accomplished the coronation of the son of Charles VI, the Dauphin, as Charles VII, King of France.
Joan's combat style was somewhat unusual, says Crane.
It seems as if Joan's goal is to be as successful a military leader as she can in conventional terms of battle, that is, by winning victories. At the same time, she does fight in an unusual way, that is, in preferring her banner to her sword, in not killing people herself.
In the end, Joan had a very short military career.
Within a year of setting out from home, she had been captured.
Her interrogation lasted 3 months.
And when she was condemned as a heretic and turned over to the English to be burned, she was only perhaps 20 years old.
Crane has studied the transcripts of Joan's trial, which are extensive,
and give us access to Joan's own voice, to her own statements about her life as a warrior.
The goal of the trial for heresy was to discredit Joan as the savior of France and to undermine the French claim that their cause was supported by God.
One way that the judges go about doing that is to set Joan's male clothing, her insistence on wearing male clothing, against her desire to receive communion and to attend Mass.
At one point, the judges agree to let her hear Mass if she will wear a dress. But then they equivocate, insisting she continue to wear women's clothing.
Joan rejects that deal. She said that as to the woman's dress, she would not take it yet, not until it pleased our Lord. This insistence on waiting to take women's clothing until a future time is consonant with her insistence that she must remain virginal, that she has pledged her virginity to God. She seems to associate her virginity and her dress in relation to one another as showing that she has a mission from God, that she is different from other women, that she can do things other women can't do.
Crane suggests that Joan's virginity is a key element in her construction as a warrior.
In that sexuality is seen with great suspicion inside the Christian faith at this point in history, that virginity is a kind of purity that keeps one closer to God, that sets one beyond the earthly entanglements of sin. And that virginity, in some sense, takes her out of the status of woman puts a little distance between the characteristic subordination of women and her status as a leader of men.
In the end, Joan refuses to give up masculine dress.
She doesn't consider her mission to be over. So at that point, when her clothing appears not just functional, but somehow symbolic, I think that's where we can see Joan moving from being a familiar kind of idealized defender of France to being something more surprising, something that indeed could cause Orthodox Christians of the Middle Ages some doubts about her orthodoxy. The success of the judges in her trial was in showing at the very end of her trial that she preferred wearing men's clothing to going to confession. And that was one of the elements on which they charged her as a heretic, that she was wrongly committed to men's clothing rather than to confessing.
Although Charles VII made no attempt to ransom Joan after her capture, he did organize a rehabilitation trial for her 2 decades after her death.
At the end of that trial, the record of her first trial was sentenced to be torn into tiny bits, lacerated. But that was the extent of the support that Charles VII gave to Joan after her capture. And it came a very long time after her trial and death.
I'm Sally Claxon, and you're listening to What's the Word? A program made possible through support from the Modern Language Association of America, an organization that encourages the study of language and literature.
Maxine Hong Kingston's The Woman Warrior, her first book, came out in 1976 and won the Best Book for Nonfiction from the National Book Critics Circle. It's a book that's had a tremendous influence, not only in Asian American literature, but in all of U.S. canonical writing, I would say. It's pushed the boundaries of what we consider to be autobiographical and memoir writing. It gives us a whole new legend for women of color, the legend of Fa Mulan, the woman warrior.
Shirley Lim is a professor in the English department at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She is the author of several books, including Among the White Moon Faces, a memoir, and the 2006 novel Sister Swing, and the editor of Approaches to Teaching the Woman Warrior. In an essay, Maxine Hong Kingston writes,
"We cannot find the scenes where a myth leaves off and a life and imagination begin." And that was the challenge she took for herself. The Fa Mulan, Chinese woman warrior, is a very ancient figure. Going back to the 5th century AD, I would say, there have been various versions across the centuries in the Ming and Qing and even in the Tang dynasties. In the modern era, during China's war against Japan, Fa Mulan, the woman warrior, was staged as patriotic drama.
The original figure of the woman warrior in China came from a folk poem.
This is a very short folk poem which hardly outlines the major details of the story. A young girl takes on her father's duty, which is to serve in the army for the emperor against the northern barbarians. She puts on male costume, she cross-dresses, and then becomes a famous general. And when the victories are won, she returns home and becomes a Confucianist woman, submissive to her parents and to her husband all over again. So in many ways, while we American women see Fa Mulan, the woman warrior, as a feminist text, in ancient China, she was very much a Confucianist heroine, if that contradiction makes sense. In the original poem, which then, of course, gets re-narrated and becomes more colorful, the young girl follows a bird up the mountains, round and round up into the sky. And what she learns from the old man and woman who raise her for the next 15 years is how to be eating only nuts and fruits. She learns to withstand hunger. She learns to travel very long distances. And, of course, she learns the martial arts. Above all, I think the mist shows how she's able to use her mind to conjure from empty air swords and weapons to defeat the enemies in front of her.
Kingston's retelling adds to the original.
In her retelling, there is a richness of characterization that is missing in the original poem and in all the various restagings found in China, in the Hollywood movies, for example. Let's look at a passage where she talks about what happens to the young girl as she lives up in the sky with the old man and the old woman. I learned to make my mind large as the universe is large, so that there is room for paradoxes. Pearls are bone marrow. Pearls come from oysters. The dragon lives in the sky, ocean, marshes, and mountains. And the mountains are also its cranium. Its voice thunders and jingles like copper pans. It breathes fire and water. And sometimes the dragon is one, sometimes many.
Kingston introduces Fa Mulan in her chapter called White Tigers. She recalls that her mother told her stories about Fa Mulan.
The chapter begins, "When we Chinese girls listened to the adults talking story, we learned that we failed if we grew up to be but wives or slaves. We could be heroines, swordswomen." And immediately we see how Kingston is trying to overturn the stereotype of China as a patriarchal society where women are not empowered. And the chapter continues later. "Night after night, my mother would talk story until we fell asleep. I couldn't tell where the stories left off and the dreams began. Her voice, the voice of the heroines in my sleep. And on Sundays, from noon to midnight, we went to the movies at the Confucius Church. We saw swordswomen jump over houses from a standstill."
In a culture that placed so many restrictions on women, Kingston notes in her memoir, it is paradoxical that her mother gave her the role model of the swordswoman. Lim reads,
"I had forgotten this chant that was once mine, given me by my mother, who may not have known its power to remind. She said, I would grow up a wife and a slave. But she taught me the song of the warrior woman, Fa Mulan. I would have to grow up a warrior woman." So what faces the young girl in her imagination are these two paths. The path the mother models for her, being a wife and a slave, and the path that the mother's stories map out for her, the song of the warrior woman.
The Fa Mulan myth was probably new to many readers in the United States who did not come from a Chinese background, says Lim.
But in 1998, Disney took over the myth and brought out a movie called Mulan, which was very popular. And so at this point, I think in many ways, Maxine Hong Kingston has succeeded in her intention to make Mulan an American myth.
"It is significant," Kingston writes, "that Fa Mulan raises an army that does not rape or pillage, but defeats its enemies."
We find that the narrator ends the entire tale in this manner. "The swordswoman and I are not so dissimilar. What we have in common are the words at our backs. The ideographs for revenge are report a crime and report to five families. The reporting is the vengeance, not the beheading, not the gutting, but the words." And of course, what we have here is a wonderful reimagining of that old saying that the pen is mightier than the sword. So that's what we have to remember when we think about the Fa Mulan tale, that finally it is a tale of peace rather than a tale of combat.
Lim sees parallels between the story of Fa Mulan and Joan of Arc. And at one point, Kingston also compares the two women warriors.
In a particular passage, she notes, marriage and childbirth strengthen the swordswoman, who is not a maid like Joan of Arc. Do the woman's work, then do more work, which will become ours too. End quote. So she herself, in telling the tale, notes that this is not a European tale. Joan of Arc, of course, remains a virgin and dies at the stake. Fa Mulan marries and ends up in domestic bliss, one might say, and far away from the battlefield.
I'm Sally Plaxen, and you're listening to What's the Word? Women Warriors.
G.I. Jane was released in the U.S. in 1997. It generated a lot of attention, a lot of interest in media commentary. Its central character, played by Demi Moore, is a figure who raises certain anxieties about the gender identity of the military woman.
Yvonne Tasker is a professor of film and television studies at the University of East Anglia in the United Kingdom. She's the author of Spectacular Bodies, Gender, Genre, and the Action Cinema. In the late 1990s, when G.I. Jane was made, there was significant media attention on military women.
G.I. Jane's U.S. release coincided with extensive coverage given to the admission policies and violent rituals associated with male-only military colleges, VMI and the Citadel, which had either reluctantly or through legal intervention, opened the doors to women at that point.
In the wake of these events, says Tasker, both policymakers and journalists were asking questions.
What does a military woman look like? Who is she? How can we sort of visualize her?
These questions are taken up by G.I. Jane's director, Ridley Scott.
A filmmaker who's very much associated with quite spectacular action films, but also with strong roles for women. He directed Alien and Thelma and Louise.
In G.I. Jane, Demi Moore plays Jordan O'Neill, a naval intelligence officer.
So what you have in the narrative of the film is a somewhat unlikely scenario in which there's a pressure for full gender integration in the military, and specifically the Navy. And under this pressure, the military leaders, who are all men, agree to a test case, and they nominate the most grueling program on the assumption that no woman could possibly succeed.
The program is the Navy SEALs.
Access to the SEALs training program is presented as a privilege, as an opportunity to be part of an elite male force. So this heightens the stakes, if you like.
To fill the post, a scheming senator who later betrays Jordan sifts through a series of photographs of possible women.
And rejects those who look too mannish, those who might potentially bring bad publicity, and explicitly looks for someone who is media friendly, someone who is attractive, who can give a good interview after the whole process is complete. So there's a kind of vetting process. There's a desire to find an individual, a female, who can present a feminine face to the media. This is, of course, deeply ironic, since the film centers on the transformation of Moore from that kind of intelligence-based, kind of almost white-collar version of military service to a much more physical, muscular, down-and-dirty version of what military service is.
In generic terms, says Tasker, the movie sets up its female protagonist, Jordan, as an underdog.
So we know she will succeed, but she's set up to fail, more or less. And what G.I. Jane does is effectively to confront its female protagonists with two distinct sets of enemies. So you have the machinations of politicians in Washington, who are military leaders, but also those involved more directly in the funding of the military, more bureaucrats, if you like. She's also facing the antagonism of her military peers, that is, the soldiers with whom she has to work, who are extremely resentful of her presence. So what you have in G.I. Jane is quite a fantastic scenario. It's a fantasy because at the time of the film's release, the end of the 90s, military women did not have a combat role. They were excluded from combat. And what the film does is to fantasize what it would be like if a woman, an exceptional woman, were to be included in a very physically demanding, very grueling training program, and ultimately, right at the very end of the film, if she were to be included in a combat situation. And for the most part of G.I. Jane, the battle that the heroine faces is actually with the military as an institution, which more or less openly does not want her.
Jordan goes to some lengths to avoid special treatment.
She wants to be treated the same as the men she's competing with. Jordan starts out her training in a separate barracks where she's alone, since she's the only woman on the CRT course. And she starts with very long hair, which keeps getting in her way during the exercises. At a crucial moment, she decides to insist on equal treatment. She, in fact, demands equal treatment, confronting a senior officer and then proceeding to shave her head and move into the male barracks.
G.I. Jane, says Tasker, uses the conventions of the training camp film.
Of the boot camp film. And that film typically follows a narrative in which a disparate group of characters are brought together and, through the course of the training program, learn about themselves, learn to work together, as well as developing as soldiers, as a military unit. So there's a sense of personal evolution and of professional evolution.
In the end, there are moments when we see Jordan being included.
Finally being accepted as a member of the male military community, they sing her praises during the combat sequences or after the combat sequences, and ultimately she is included and has a sense of belonging, as it were. So the narrative trajectory is of inclusion.
The movie walks a fine line in depicting Jordan's strength, says Tasker.
G.I. Jane is evidently aware of both the pleasures of its heroine's muscular body. There are all manner of fetishistic shots as she is doing push-ups, for instance, but equally aware of the anxieties that that kind of body might provoke. Is she strong enough to get the job done? Is she rendered potentially lesbian by her strength? Is she still sexy despite looking mannish? Get worked out in a scenario that shows, yes, she can get the job done. No, she clearly isn't a lesbian. The allegation is made and then denied. And yes, Demi Moore remains an A-list sexually attractive female film star. So both the pleasures of spectacle and the anxieties that that spectacle provoke are simultaneously present within the film.
In some ways, Tasker suggests, G.I. Jane represents the culmination of a certain kind of cinematic portrayal of the action heroine.
Films featuring muscular, even mannish female protagonists in the 80s and 90s received a lot of attention. For example, the character of Ripley, played by Sigourney Weaver in Alien and Aliens, or the character played by Linda Hamilton in Terminator 2, which came out at the beginning of the 90s. So there was a perception that perhaps Hollywood action films were moving towards a more physically tough incarnation of the female heroine.
In the late 90s, after the release of G.I. Jane, says Tasker, this began to change.
Something very different happens, and Hollywood settles on the model which is now familiar to us, which is a version of the action heroine as sexy and tough simultaneously. And you have a successful cycle of semi-humorous and explicitly eroticized images of female violence, and that goes from films like Charlie's Angels to Kill Bill. It's clear from contemporary films that Hollywood has set aside its initial reluctance to cast women as credible protagonists in action, adventure, or fantasy scenarios, but this is only done within particular parameters. That is, either it's funny, it's comic, parodic maybe, or it's sexy. And G.I. Jane is very different from that. We're asked to take seriously the physical achievements and martial prowess of its protagonist. We're not meant to laugh.
This edition of What's the Word? Women Warriors was written, produced, and narrated by Sally Plaxton. Technical director, Duke Marcos. Production coordinator, Lee Morgan. For a list of works mentioned on this program, please write the Modern Language Association of America, 26 Broadway, 3rd floor, New York, New York, 10004. And ask for a copy of the list for program number 209. Or call 646-576-5102. That's 646-576-5102. To listen to other programs in the series, visit our website, www.mla.org. Join us next time on What's the Word?
What's the Word? Women Warriors on today's WHFR Journal. I'm Alan Mazurek. Thanks so much for being with us. The blues is also the word, and that's what we've got to make room for now. That's all the time we've got for our program today. We do hope you've enjoyed it. Kitty Love standing by to take us on a trip down Highway 61. Some blues for our Friday afternoon here on WHFR Making Waves. From the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn at 89.3, online at WHFR.fm, making waves. Have a great weekend. We'll be back next Friday with more on the WHFR Journal.
WHFR.fm is your home for Super Dorky Radio every single Thursday from 8 to 11 on The Jump Button. Tune in to hear music from video games, cartoons, anime, and more every Thursday from 8 to 11 p.m. only here on WHFR.fm, the station making waves.
Listener supported. Non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Featuring local and independent artists.
That's where my